From these first two miracles, Jesus needs a lesson in showmanship. This is bad magic.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the Bible Geeks Podcast. This is episode 24. I'm Brian Sheely.
I'm Ryan Joy.
And thanks so much everyone for tuning in. Today on the episode, we're going to be answering the tough question, where do we go when times get tough? But before we get into that, and before we get into our Jesus Said segment, we've got a pretty big announcement to make. And that's about a new project that we're starting beginning August 1st, and we're calling it Bible Geeks Daily Download.
Yeah, it's really exciting. We're going to have these daily pieces, Monday through Friday, that you can read, you can listen to on a podcast, on a separate subscription channel. You can watch it as videos on YouTube, and we certainly would encourage folks to subscribe to that new podcast feed. I think you should be able to find it now or here in the next couple days. We'll still be doing this weekly show like we always have been, but this will just be a short little tidbit that hopefully gives you some encouragement, some edification, a little moment in the Word, and a thought to take with you for your day.
And so you can go to BibleGeeks.fm/daily, and you can find out more information about that. We've got a little trailer up there introducing the series. And beginning August 1st, you'll be seeing this every weekday. So check it out. Hopefully it'll be useful for you. A little nugget to stick in your pocket every morning. So
pocket nuggets.
Pocket nuggets. Yeah. All right. So let's get into our Jesus Said segment this week. And I've got a verse for you. And that's in Matthew chapter 11, beginning in verse 28. Now, in the context here, Jesus is mixing a prayer to the Father with a conversation to his disciples. And so here in verse 28, he's transitioned from talking to God directly, and now he's talking to his disciples. And he says, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." So what do you think?
The concept of rest is something I've been thinking about a lot lately. And
are you tired?
You know my life.
Yes, I do.
I think that sometimes I have thought of rest as that break that I need, just taking a really good nap, which is wonderful, as we've talked about before, or just getting a few moments to yourself. But as I've recently studied rest in Scripture, I've started to realize that there's something else going on in this idea of rest, and it starts right there in Genesis 2, whenever God rested. And of course, God didn't need a nap, and he didn't need to take a coffee break after creating the world. He stopped, and the idea there, I think, is that he sat down, so to speak, like Jesus, after he accomplished all of his work, sat down at the right hand of God, not to take a break, but having accomplished creation, God sits down to rule. It is him saying, find order and stability under my rule. And so, you know, how nice to not have to force our way, fight for order, fight for a chance to just take a breath and know it's all right.
Yeah.
So that's the thing that jumps out at me, is this offer of rest. What, I mean, there's so much here. What are you drawn to in this invitation?
He's not saying there's nothing to do, because in one sentence he says, take my yoke upon you, learn from me, and you'll find rest for your souls. Taking a yoke, that's work. I mean, that's binding two ox together and making them plow the field together. That is not the idea of just doing nothing. And as John says in 1 John 5, verse 3, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. It's still about following his rule. And I think what you said just really highlights that point. He is bringing order and stability, but it means that we still have to follow him and we still have to work, but have no fear. His commandments are not burdensome. His yoke is easy. His burden is light. it's still a burden, but we can bear it.
Yeah, if you're going to be bound to a yoke with someone, how about being bound to a yoke with Jesus?
Yeah.
And sharing that load. And the sense of being heavy laden is a weight that is just frustrating you, I think, as opposed to doing your work with this gentle partner, this one who is lowly in heart and with fruitfulness and effectiveness and with joy and with, I don't want to say ease, but he does say my yoke is easy. So there's a sense of, not that life is easy, because it's not, but that with the Lord, there is an ease to our life that is not there. There is a velocity to the way we move forward that we haven't been able to find before, where at every turn we were thwarted. But now, though there's difficulty, we find a different kind of forward momentum in Him. We find a different kind of work to do, that we know, even when it doesn't always look like it here, we know is made fruitful by the Lord Himself.
In a sense, He sees me. He sees exactly what I'm dealing with. He sees what I'm struggling with. He says, if times are tough for you and you're under heavy strain, come to me. Come to me. I'm the one who you need to come to. Yeah. Because I can take care of that for you.
That's a great image. You know, whenever somebody says, come to me, what are they saying? They're extending their hand, and you just can see Jesus saying, come on, come on.
Yeah.
Come on over here. I've got something that you need, and you know you need it, and I'm willing to share it.
So in a similar sense, we're going to go back in our next segment to David, who did the same thing with the Lord in a segment that we call Poetry in Motion.
Yeah, so we're going to keep moving forward. We've been going through the Psalms, and now we're on Psalm 5. And if you want to take out your Bible, if you're somewhere that you can do that, that's great. But if not, just kind of follow along with David's thoughts as we go through this. And it's a beautiful prayer. It is a morning prayer. And we've been seeing this movement between an evening prayer and a morning prayer. So Psalm 3, there was a morning prayer, and Psalm 4 was an evening prayer, and Psalm 5 is a morning prayer, and Psalm 6, the next psalm, is going to be an evening prayer again. So I think there's this idea that the compiler of the Psalms is trying to get across, that from day to night, we should be surrounded by prayer. The best way to start the morning is prayer. The best way to end the day is prayer. And so he starts with this prayer, give ear to my words. So he says, hear me, basically, over and over again here in verses 1 and 2. And he says, you're the one I pray to, and you do hear me, and you hear me in the morning. So the key verse in this first three verses, I think, is verse 2, where he says, give attention to the sound of my cry, my King and my God, for to you do I pray. I'm not praying to anybody else. I'm the King, but you're my King. And you're my God. And that word my claims him. It says, I'm in covenant relationship with you, and you're the only one I turn to. And he uses three different words to describe these prayers, and it can almost see it bubbling forward to the surface from his innermost parts. And the first word, he says, consider my groaning. The NEB translates it, my inmost thoughts. You know, I'm sighing, I'm groaning. Derek Kidner says, it's a barely audible self-communing, but there is a growing clarity, he says, as it breaks out into a cry for help. In verse 2, he says, give attention to the sound of my cry, and then into articulate, disciplined, and expectant prayer. So he says, you've heard my voice as I pray for you. And so this sets up the whole prayer where he's just saying, Lord, hear me. But what is causing David to groan?
it is in a very similar sense as some of the other Psalms that we've looked at because of these people around him who are evil, who are liars, who are rebellious against God. And David is burdened down. He's weighted down with their sin and what they're doing. And he is basically calling on God to be the champion of what's right. He's calling on God to hate wickedness in verse 4, to hate pride and evil, and acknowledging him as the one who destroys all of these liars, all of these people who are bloodthirsty and deceitful. And the key verse here in verses 4-6, I think is verse 4, where he says, "For you are not a God who delights in wickedness. Evil may not dwell with you." And I love that idea that God is so opposed to evil that he doesn't want to dwell with it. He doesn't want to make a home with it. And he doesn't want any part in it. And so David, in his groaning over these people, is basically casting his cares on God. He's coming to God and saying, "God, you are my king who hates these kinds of things." And he uses the word hate or abhor. And these are very strong words. These are intense kinds of words. And this intensity about the way that God feels towards sin, I think, is notable here and important for us because God is not happy with sin. He's not just passively accepting people who are practicing sin and doing these kinds of evil things. He hates it. He abhors it. And so if God hates that kind of behavior, if God hates sin that much, then how do I feel about it? How do I feel about sin? Do I want to dwell with sin? Do I want to make a home with sin? Do I want to get as close as I can to sin? Or do I, like God, hate it and abhor it to the point where I don't want anything to do with it? And so he's calling on God basically to take care of this situation for him, take care of these people who are behaving in this way. So then, where does David go when he's faced with all these evildoers and these rebellious people around him?
He enters God's house. And so that's what verses 7-9 describe. And he says, "But I enter." And I think that word "but" is the key word here because he's contrasting everything you just said with himself. And he says, they can't dwell with you because evil can't dwell with you, and they're bloodthirsty, and that's what they're interested in. But I, through the abundance of your love, will enter. And there's that word, chesed.
There it is again.
And so this idea that he's making a contrast, but I will come to you. I can't come to you because I'm so great, but I do fear you and I do desire you. And because of your abundant, steadfast love, you, through this compassion and through this covenantal faithfulness, let me come to you. And I think the key verse is verse 9, and this is a verse that Paul quotes in Romans 3. When you read it in Romans 3, you actually find yourself getting convicted because he's saying everybody is guilty of sin. But he says about these evil people, there is no truth in their mouth. It starts with the mouth, and then he goes into the inmost being. He says their inmost self is destruction. And then he comes back out saying what comes from their inmost self, their throat is an open grave, which is just gross.
Yeah.
And they flatter with their tongue. So mouth, inmost self, throat, and tongue, and every part of it is full of lies, is full of death, full of destruction. There's no truth in it. There's only flattery. And what do you do when you look around and you see this kind of wickedness coming from everybody's mouth that's around you, and all the things you see in the media, all the things that, you know, somebody is talking about you, all the things that somebody is saying on some social media is troubling you? What do? We could complain about it. We could be overwhelmed by it. No, what David does is he approaches God.
right,
approaches God because his steadfast love leads him. And so he asks him, lead me, Lord, in your righteousness. And so that's what he's praying for himself, is for God to lead him. But what does he pray for the wicked? And what does he pray for the righteous around him?
Yeah, so he kind of has two people in mind in these last three verses, verses 10 through 12. He starts with the wicked and he asks for justice against them, those rebellious people, pronounce them guilty. And then in verse 11, he transitions to talking about those who call on the Lord, who take refuge in him, saying that the Lord brings them joy. And then in verse 12, he says that God is a shield to them. He's a protector of them. He covers them with his favor. And I love verse 11 here because he says, but let all who take refuge in you rejoice. Let them ever sing for joy and spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may exult in you. Mm. So these are kind of defensive words. When you're faced with troubling people, people who hate you, people who are saying things about you, it's God, when you come to him and make your home with him and enter his house, it's God who protects you. It's God who gives you refuge. It's God who is your shield. And so he's not just talking about himself anymore, because he says in verse 11, but let all who take refuge in you rejoice. So this is not just personal anymore. Yeah, he started this with saying, this is my problem. I'm distressed about this. But everyone who comes to the Lord is going to find protection and is going to find this kind of refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's important for us, because we can connect with this. We can insert ourselves into these verses and saying, you know, when times get tough for me, where do I go? Who do I trust? Do I trust in my own counsel, as he talked about in verse 10? Those who trust in their own counsel are going to fall, and God is going to call them guilty. But if we trust in the Lord's counsel, if we trust in his protection and lean on him in troubling times, then he's going to protect us. And so this is super comforting, especially when you insert yourself into this psalm. And when I'm being insulted, when people hate me, when they're treating me poorly, when I see everyone around me in the world just seems to be more evil and more evil and more evil by the day, God's still there. And like Jesus said, come to me. I'm here. And he reaches out his hand and he's connecting with us, saying, I'll take care of you.
It's amazing how David always seems to come into a psalm different than he leaves it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He starts out in this very vulnerable place of just desperate for God to hear him and seeing so clearly all those around him. But his prayer, and of course, he's then crafted this prayer for us to walk through it as a transition. You know, it's like whenever you go into a tunnel on one side of a mountain going on a freeway, and you go in at one place, but you come out somewhere else. And what happens in the middle is approaching God, recognizing there is a difference between good and evil, but God holds on to the evil and he covers them up with his wing, so to speak, with himself as a shield.
That's good stuff. So that's Psalm 5. And now we're going to transition this to a similar topic, which is a continuation of our series from last week about the miracles of Jesus in John. We're going to get into his second miracle in a segment that we call Here's Your Sign.
In the car, and it's got a ski rack on it, and we was putting the skis up in the ski rack. And the guy at the car right next to me goes, you going skiing? I said, nope, we put them on top of the car in case we flip over on an icy road. Here's your sign.
So we're working our way through the seven signs in John's gospel, and we saw Jesus turn water to wine in the first sign back in Cana of Galilee. And here he is in John chapter 4, verse 46, back in Cana of Galilee. And John doesn't want us to miss that he's back there. He even says, this is where he made water wine. And here we find a new character. There's an official whose son is ill, and he hears Jesus is in town. And he runs up to him and he asks him to come wherever his home is, wherever his son is, and heal his son who's on the brink of death. And so the stakes are really high here. The stakes are high for this man because his son is about to die. And, you know, just imagine how awful that would be. But the stakes are even higher, really, because Jesus is going through the world with a mission of bringing faith. Mm-hmm. And so you see both of these priorities at work in a little exchange that Jesus has with this man in verses 48 and 49. And Jesus' response to this man is that he needs to believe, and he won't believe unless he sees signs and wonders. And the man just says, "Sir, come down before my kid dies." And so Jesus makes a promise, and he promises, "Okay, your son will live." The man doesn't find out that the son is going to live until he gets back there, but then he finds out at just the time Jesus said, "Your son will live," that's when he got better. And the man believed Jesus when he heard the promise, and then all the household believes that Jesus is who he says he was, and this was the second sign.
I connect with this official in a big way, you know, because as a parent, what could cause me to leave my son's bedside, especially when they were sick and nearing death? What would cause me to leave? I think that would be the time where I wouldn't want to go anywhere. I would want to be right there. But he leaves because he knows something. And, you know, I remember a time back before Ashlyn was born, I was actually asked to go on a business trip a month before she was born. And that's like go time, right? Like, you don't want to leave the house when you know that due date is approaching. And I had to go, and I was there, you know, doing my work out in the East Coast. And at the end of my time there, they said, "Okay, can you stay for another week?" I was like, no, I'm not going to stay another week. That whole idea of just, you know, something big is happening at home, but you leave. And he does that. And I can only imagine the kind of stress that he's going through. But why does he leave? He leaves because he knows something is possible. And I don't know how he knew that. From the whole account here, I mean, what had Jesus done prior to this? And it's not even clear whether or not this official knew about the water being turned to wine prior to this. But what did the official know? Why did he leave? Mm-hmm. Why do you think he even thought Jesus was able to do this?
Well, Jesus is starting to get a reputation, but I think that you don't even have to know for sure. Whenever the circumstances are dire enough, you hope. And you are willing to throw whatever money it takes at a hope, at a possibility. And what if this Jesus that everybody's talking about is that special one who could do something about this? And yeah. Whenever Jesus does say, "Your son will live," he moves beyond a wish, a hope, a dream, and he actually believes. Yeah. And, you know, Jesus inspires that kind of confidence in us if we're really paying attention. And this is a virtue that's described in this man, that whenever Jesus says it, he believes it. But yeah, I mean, you do not want to leave your kid whenever there's something awful going on. What if that was your last moment with them?
Well, and it would have been, from the appearance of it, it would have probably been his last moment with his son.
Yeah.
This is just the essence of faith. This man is full of faith to the point where he's never even heard of Jesus doing anything like this before, but he's confident that this man can do something about it. Mm. You know, he's full of what if. He's full of the possibilities of what Jesus can do, and he's not in any way limiting what Jesus is capable of. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me a whole lot of Noah. You know, Noah had, by all accounts, had probably never even heard of rain or never even seen rain before. And God comes to him and says, "I'm going to flood the whole earth." And so he spends his entire life building the ark, not even having any conception of what God is talking about. And it reminds me of Abraham, as God tells him to go take up his son and kill him on the mountain. We find out later in the book of Hebrews that he had this idea that God could raise him from the dead. Now, how many people do you think Abraham had ever seen God raise from the dead prior to this?
None.
None, right? Like, So he's thinking this in his mind, not having any conception, not having any concrete proof. And so do I acknowledge that God is able to do impossible things in my life? And that's just one of the biggest things I get from this is like, I don't know why he trusted Jesus. I don't know why he believed Jesus could do this, but he did. Mm-hmm. He did, to the point where he left his child's bedside, who was about to die, did something that many of us would just never even think. And he does it, and Jesus fixes the problem.
Whenever we ask God to do a great work in our lives, we're asking God to do what he has always done, which is be in control of the universe,
right?
And to love his people and to care for them, just like David prayed in Psalm 5, just like this man asks. And we don't have a miracle worker walking amongst us, but our prayers can work wonders. That's, I think, the point of James 5, that
right,
Elijah could do these amazing things by just praying. And it says, and he was a man just like us.
Yeah. And just not limiting God. I mean, that's, I think, the biggest piece of this is not limiting what he can do, not limiting what he's able to do, but just accepting all of the possibilities of what he could accomplish, however he's going to do that. And I couldn't give you a step-by-step list of how he's going to do that, but God can do amazing things. And through our prayers, we can do amazing things with his help.
That word that you used is really powerful, that word possibilities.
Yeah.
Whenever we pray into possibilities, not into certainty, God is going to do this because I know, or I can control God, or I'm certain of what God's plan is, but perhaps, to go back to Philemon, God will act, because when I pray into a world of possibilities, because with God, all things are possible.
Yeah, so what do you get from this?
I love what you said about what is possible and the importance of trusting God and trusting Jesus. And I think there's a lesson in the timing of faith here. Mm. This story is about a guy believing Jesus far away from where the miracle actually would happen. Jesus isn't near the miracle. The man can't see the miracle has happened, but he believes him. And so there's this order, the sequence of faith, really, where there's a promise from Jesus in verse 50. There's faith immediately in verse 51. And then there's sight. Promise, faith, sight. And that's really how it works for us, right?
Right.
You know, as soon as Jesus spoke the promise, it was done. And whether it happens chronologically in our lives that way or not, it might as well be done as soon as God speaks the promise, because it's that certain. The answer had already come for this man as soon as the promise came, but he couldn't see it. He got home, he said, wow, he's better. When did this happen? And he did the math. Okay, that was a 30-minute walk back from the village. Wow, that is exactly when Jesus said that.
Right.
And so we start to learn something about waiting on the Lord, this phrase that the whole Bible, especially the Old Testament, uses a lot. Lamentations 3 and Isaiah 40 are two of the great passages on it. But waiting on the Lord is not about standing in line and just, you know, like we have to wait to ride a roller coaster because the line is so long. And so you have to wait, or you have to wait in the waiting room at the dentist's office. Waiting on the Lord is about trusting the Lord in that gap between the promise and sight. And between promise and sight is faith. And the Bible calls that waiting on the Lord. And you brought up Abraham, and Paul uses a great phrase to describe what Abraham did whenever he chose to hope in the Lord. And we use this phrase as kind of like a colloquialism now. He talks about hoping against hope in Romans 4:18, that Abraham hoped against hope,
right,
that God actually would do what seemed impossible. And we have to hope against hope. We have to wait on the Lord and trust him that he has actually heard us and he has answered. And we might not see the fruit of that answer for a long time, but we wait on him and we trust. We are under the shadow of his wings. He is our shield.
And this is another great example just from the first miracle. Jesus didn't himself pour the water into the jars. Jesus didn't himself go and present the wine to the people at the party. He relied on his servants to do that. Jesus doesn't need to be there. He doesn't need to be doing the work. He didn't need to go to his house. He just had to say it. And again, I think that's just an amazing part of this miracle, again, is that Jesus is not himself doing some amazing thing. Jesus is able to make amazing things happen just by speaking.
I think whenever you think of doing great miracles, you think of a spectacle. And it looks like from these first two miracles, Jesus needs a lesson in showmanship. This is bad magic. This is a faith healer today. You know, the people who go around saying they're healing people would never go for this kind of like incognito miracles, I think. This is Jesus either on the down low in a wedding, just letting it be taken care of behind the scenes so that everyone can keep going on with the festivities, or here, Jesus saying, yeah, it's taken care of. You'll find out when you get there, and moving on. And his disciples didn't even see it. But imagine what this man carried with him from that exchange with Jesus. Maybe he never saw him again in his whole life, but his life was changed.
Yeah, I love that, incognito miracles. That's exactly what he's doing here. And yeah, if we would expect Jesus to be doing some amazing thing by these outward signs and these public displays, that's not what Jesus is doing. Mm-hmm. He's behind the scenes. He's being quiet about it. And there are so many times throughout the Gospels where he does amazing things. And then he tells people, don't say anything about this. I know you've seen some amazing things. I know you've just witnessed me raise someone from the dead or heal somebody who is sick or heal someone's illness, but just keep it quiet. And I think that's another mark of Jesus's uncharacteristic ministry. He is not doing this for fame and glory. He is doing it for glory, but he's not doing it to become some amazingly popular person. He's doing it to prove, as we talked about last week, to prove that he's the Son of God.
Mm-hmm. Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So as we think about how we work this in our own lives, what do you see as a challenge for us in Psalm 5 and this passage as we kind of fold them together?
Yeah, so I think a great challenge for this episode is to pray to God, morning or evening, pray to God and ask him to resolve some kind of troubling situation in your own life or in the lives of someone else. And that, I think, applies to this man here. He wasn't praying for himself specifically. He was praying for his son. Mm-hmm. And I think we all know people in our lives. We all have connections and know that there are some people who are going through some really difficult challenges in life, who are burdened. And we, as a third party, can pray on their behalf and ask God to do amazing things in their life and see what he'll do.
Don't limit God. Look around for where he can make a difference and call on his name.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for tuning into the Bible Geeks podcast. You can find us on our website at BibleGeeks.fm. As we mentioned at the top of the show, if you want to follow along with us and subscribe to our daily download, you can go to BibleGeeks.fm/daily. You can also find us on social media. We are /TheBibleGeeks wherever you might find us. And until next week, everyone, may the Lord bless you and keep you.
Shalom.